Congratulations to the Springboks. Well done. You have made us all very proud to be South Africans in the world. You remind us again so powerfully of that proud day in 1995 when we not only won the Rugby World Cup, but even more importantly, celebrated ourselves as one nation, uniting behind our victorious team.
Nelson Mandela, paying homage to the 1995 South African team, the Springboks. In 1995, tension in South Africa was growing between blacks and whites after the country's first democratic election. A solution occurred to the new South African president, Nelson Mandela. Bring the country together around the game of rugby. Journalist John Carlin writes about the story in his book Playing the Enemy, Nelson Mandela and the Game That Made a Nation. He told Steve Paulson that selling black South Africans on the game of rugby was no easy task.
Rugby was a deeply divisive symbol in South Africa, and in particular, the South African national rugby team, known as the Springboks, and more particularly still, the green jersey, which the Springboks wore. And so this was seen, on the one hand, by white South Africans as an object of almost religious veneration, whereas for black South Africans, the green Springbok jersey was seen as a very potent and detested symbol of apartheid oppression, right up there with the old South African national flag and the old South African national anthem.
So here is Nelson Mandela, the celebrated leader of the ANC, who has just been elected president of South Africa. He's doing everything he can to unite the country. How does he use rugby as a way to do this?
Well, yes, I should say unite the country and also to stop the country from subsiding into what could have been a quite dreadful civil war. You know, when Mandela came to power in 1994, things remained very fragile, and he himself, in his inaugural speech, made the point that the clouds of war still hung over the country. So what he did was he, a year before the tournament began, in other words, shortly after he came to power in 1994, he summoned the captain of the South African rugby team, the Springboks, this large, blonde, white son of apartheid, to his office, and he basically won him over. He won him over to his cause, he made friends with him, and he conveyed to him the message that he was going to employ rugby as an instrument of national unification, and he enlisted him to the cause. And what happened was that then the rugby player, as it were, took the ball and ran with it. He took very seriously what Mandela said. He spread the message to the rest of his teammates, who were hardly the most politically enlightened types. Almost all of them were white. And among other things, he persuaded them to learn the new national anthem, which for many, many years before had been the anthem of black protest. And this was an extraordinary symbolic gesture, which was received extremely well, if with quite a lot of bafflement initially, by black South Africa. And it was in this way that gradually, with an awful lot of gestures of this type, that Mandela, working together with the rugby team and working on his own, worked on reversing this traditional antipathy that black South Africans felt towards the Springbok rugby team.
And didn't this rugby team actually learn to sing the national anthem in Xhosa?
That's the point. In Mandela's language, which, let me tell you, is a mightily difficult language to learn and indeed to pronounce, if you don't happen to have been practically born talking it. And yes, it was not long before the World Cup tournament actually began, in May 1994, that these vast, hulking rugby players found themselves in this hotel's conference room being given a lesson by a choir mistress who spoke Mandela's language, Xhosa. And they learned it. And initially, they were baffled, they were perplexed. This is a song that they'd heard many times on TV, but they always associated it with what one of the rugby players described to me in an interview I did for the book as the black danger. So the whole thing was very perplexing for them. But at the same time, they got into it. They had begun to understand by now that they weren't just rugby players, they were now political players. And the song itself is extraordinarily powerful and moving. And this choir session went surprisingly, unbelievably well, in fact, so much so that at the end of it, when the whole thing had been, the session had been terminated, three of the very largest members of the South African rugby team, three big, enormous Afrikaners, said, "Please, miss, can we sing it again, just the three of us?" And the three of them were old buddies who'd actually been singing in choirs, it so happened, for some years together. And to the amazement of their teammates and the choir mistress, the three of them sang this extraordinarily moving rendition of what had always been a song of black protest, a symbol, as I said before, for these guys of what they called the black danger.
Now, it would be hard enough for Nelson Mandela to win over all these white players on the rugby team, but the much harder task, I would think, would be to actually convince all those tens of millions of black South Africans to support the national rugby team, which had been this symbol of oppression. I mean, those, as you say, those green jerseys had symbolized apartheid.
Yes, and so much so that actually for many years before this, whenever foreign teams would come to South Africa to play rugby against the Springbok team, you would always have a small group of black people in the stadium in a special area reserved for blacks who always, always invariably supported the opposite team, the foreign team, whoever the Springboks were playing against. And yes, and a measure of what a difficult task Mandela was handed himself, as he himself told me when I interviewed him for my book, he said that there were occasions when he would stand up at a rally before thousands of his own people, inviting them to support the Springbok team, saying, "Now, you know, they may be white, but we're now all one nation. They're now our team too." Sometimes he would put on this, well, the green Springbok cap. And as Mandela told me, half bemused in recollection, but also to some degree chortling with delight at the madness of it all, he said his own supporters would boo him at his insistence on them getting them to go along with what they'd always seen, as I say, as a symbol of apartheid oppression.
So how did he change that? How did he turn around the sentiments among all those black South Africans to support the team?
Well, I think he did it partly just through the sheer extraordinary authority and credibility that he has. I mean, he made the point so often in so many speeches and public statements that, you know, that a lot of black South Africans said, well, you know, hang on a minute, maybe, you know, if this is what Nelson Mandela is saying, we better go along with it. They also, but I think it's very important, the point that we were just making a minute ago, that the rugby team, having initially sort of started off the whole, you know, their rugby lives as politically very uncouth people who by and large would have unthinkingly supported apartheid, really began to acquire a sense of the value they could have for the nation in bringing black and white people together. And so they made the right noises. Whenever the captain spoke, whenever other players spoke, they made a point of stressing that, yes, we may be white, but we're representing every single South African. They would go along to black townships and they would engage in coaching sessions with small black kids. And like I say, they learned the anthem. And there, you know, the spectacle of these great, big, huge, hulking Afrikaners singing the traditional anthem of black protest live on national TV, on national radio, had an extraordinary force of persuasion for black South Africans. And then, of course, the team began to win their games and to win and to win and to win. And we're talking here about a very primitive sort of human reaction. You want to identify yourself with a winning team.
And yet they were playing what was considered one of the all-time great rugby teams, this team known as the New Zealand All Blacks because of their black uniforms.
That's right.
I mean, they were heavily favored going into this match.
Absolutely. I mean, you would have found it absolutely impossible to find one rugby expert in the whole world, I think, barring perhaps the most lunatically optimistic, crazily optimistic South African, who would have given the Springboks a chance of winning that game. The New Zealanders were just, they had a magnificent team. Every player was, in the rugby world, a household name. In straight sort of logical scientific terms, the South Africans had no chance that day.
So what was the atmosphere that day at the match?
Well, the atmosphere was sensational. I guess there were three things. One of them was that there was this song which Mandela used to sing when he was in prison. When he and his fellow prisoners were at the lime quarry, picking away at the lime quarry, doing brutally hard work, there was a song that they sang, this really jaunty song sung for many years by migrant black workers in South Africa called Shojoloza, which was a song that every single black person knew. And it became adopted by the rugby crowd, which was overwhelmingly white, the rugby fans, as their song too, which in itself was a gesture on their part of reaching out to black South Africa. And this small, diminutive chap, who I know very well, who sang the song very beautifully, went out onto the stadium, and we're talking here about 62, 63,000 people, the vast majority of them white. And this guy went out into the stadium an hour before and led them in a sort of choir practice, and, you know, more choir practices of this song. And there he was, this little black guy sort of, you know, bellowing out in his microphone, "Are you ready? Are you ready to sing?" And everybody's saying, "Yes." And they all sang, and they were just this extraordinary, joyous thing. Number two, what happened about half an hour before kickoff, a jumbo jet belonging to South African Airways flew ludicrously, outrageously, almost catastrophically low over the stadium and sort of emptied the full power of its jets into the stadium, making everybody sort of jump, absolutely sort of fearing that the end of the world had come. But then once they realized that it wasn't the end of the world, the impact of this extraordinary jet engine noise released a fever and electricity in the stadium that sustains it, that the whole atmosphere of the place, the rest of the game. And then the final thing, just before the game began, just after Mandela had been visiting the players in a dressing room, he came out onto the field, and people in the stadium were astonished to see him wearing this green Springbok shirt. He, of all people, he, a black man who'd been 27 years in an apartheid prison. And first there was this stunned silence, and then suddenly there was this murmur began. People started saying, "Nelson, Nelson." And the murmur grew into this crescendo, and you had basically 60,000 white people who 5 years earlier would have probably regretted bitterly the decision of the government to release Nelson Mandela, all of them in unison and with great passion, chanting over and over again, "Nelson, Nelson, Nelson."
So what happened in this rugby game?
Well, it wasn't a very beautiful rugby game. It was a bit like a sort of, I don't know, giant chess match or sort of First World War trench warfare with very little fluidity. It was a tremendously tense affair. And what happened was that there were very few points scored. What happened was that the game reached the end of regulation time and they were tied, which is very unusual, unusual in rugby as it is, almost as much as it is in American football. And they had to play extra time. And the whole thing was just extraordinarily nail-bitingly tense. And with 7 minutes to go, as it so happens, the one Jewish player in the South African team, and quite possibly the one Jewish person in the world who plays rugby, happened to be the guy, just to make the whole thing just absurdly sort of fairy tale, you know, rainbow nation, non-racial euphoria. He was the guy who scored the decisive points. And South Africa had to hold the line for the last 7 minutes. And when I interviewed Mandela on this, he said that this had been, without a shadow of a doubt, the tensest period of his entire life. And this, don't forget, is coming from a man who seriously believed back in 1964 that he was going to receive the death penalty from an apartheid judge. Hmm.
And so when South Africa finally won, jubilation just exploded around the country.
Absolutely. And that's precisely the point, that now, by the time this had come along, all that work that Mandela had done in orchestrating the response of black and white South Africa to this event all had come to fruition, and every single black and white South African wanted the Springbok team to win, which is an extraordinary thing because this is a country in which black and white South Africa never had a sort of a commonality of views or commonality of purposes. And for the first time ever, the whole country, black and white, united around one common shared national aim, which was victory for their team. And when South Africa won, the stadium went absolutely berserk, of course, but the fact is, so did the whole country. You could go to the remotest little poorest, shabbiest black township out in the fringes of the Kalahari Desert, and they were all going absolutely bonkers. The children, the old ladies, out in the streets, dancing, you know, black and white people hugging, whatever they were together. It was a quite extraordinary event. It was like, I don't know, something as rare, I think, in human experience as in the stars, when a comet passes by, Halley's Comet. It's such an extraordinary, rare moment when South Africa sort of scaled that Martin Luther King mountaintop. That mountaintop of Martin Luther King's dreams was actually achieved in the real world.
7 minutes played, with overplay van der Westhuizen, gooi in, strolly out fast van der Westhuizen, and loop naar Strensky. He goes, gets got Paletro! That's a worst skop near the home! Yeah, he's there! He's there!
John Carlin is the author of Playing the Enemy. He spoke with Steve Paulson.